You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 243 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm playoff T, Tristan Caracino.
And we are coming to you live from different locations. I'm in Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Pelton Cast.
And I'm coming to you from Washington, home of NFC West champion Seattle Seahawks.
You seem ready. Although maybe not, actually.
You wouldn't believe how unready I am.
I'm
like Chris Strebler over here.
If we know the history of the playoffs.
I'm going to podcast for 1 hour, and I'm going to throw a pick six in that hour.
You just tried to make the case to me that Chris Strebler played better than John Wolford on Sunday. So your joke is going the wrong direction here. Well, it's a big week. We have a Seahawks playoff game to preview. We have more chatter about NBA expansion. It's our first podcast of 2021. We also have a review of 2020 NFL over-unders, which we will be doing on the fly. I do not know the results. So we should get right to it.
On the fly is such a ridiculous way to put it. It's literally just looking at numbers and saying whether a number was over another number. It's not that hard.
But usually I know the results going in. I've done the work beforehand.
We've eliminated your chance to cheat here.
I suppose so, yes.
That's all we've done.
So we should jump right into it with this week's beer, which we are drinking from our friends at Hopworks Urban Brewery in Portland, the Abominable Winter Ale. Abominable is a perfect blend of caramel melts and Simcoe, Azaka, and Centennial hops, create a complex, spicy, and citrusy winter ale.
I think I just put it together that Hub and Hopworks were the same thing. You didn't know that, did you?
Well, I learned it when I was looking it up earlier today. So I was literally hours ahead of you on this one.
I've got like XL mason jar to drink this out of. This is a mason jar that holds 22 ounces of beer right here.
There you go.
It's playoff tea coming at you.
From our new sponsor, Bell. Ball. I better get it right if they're going to be a sponsor.
The Ball Pelton Cast Arena.
All right, our toast this week. We've returned to an old friend, which is the Zion Tupola Fatui toast. It's been a minute. Yeah. Was not named Pac-12 Defensive Player of the Week as the Husky season is over, but he was named to the AP All-American Third Team for his strong performance in the Huskies' shortened season. Also, exciting news for the Huskies is he announced simultaneously that he'll return for the 2021 season, though he could have entered the NFL draft as a third-year sophomore. And the Huskies getting a number of other key players back, left tackle Jackson Kirkland, meaning they'll bring back their entire 2020 offensive line, tight end Kate Otten, and fellow outside linebacker Ryan Bowman have all said they are going to be back for 2021.
There we go. Didn't we talk about this already?
No.
Was that on our year in review podcast that we talked about everybody coming back?
I guess we did.
Okay. Well,
we definitely done the weekly pod.
Pretty incredible what ZTF was able to achieve in so few games, being named as a third team All-American.
Absolutely. On a sadder note, remembering former Sonics player and head coach Paul Westfall, who died Saturday at age 70 after battling brain cancer. Westfall was inducted into the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame in September 2019 alongside his former Sonics teammate Jack Sigma. So glad he was able to enjoy that honor. And, you know, obviously, anytime a legendary player and coach passes away, you're going to hear a lot of tributes. But it really feels like they've gone above and beyond with Westfall in terms of, you know, the impact that he had on the people he played with, the people he coached, and people he just knew in the game.
Absolutely.
We also should mention here, we learned on New Year's Eve that MF Doom had died on Halloween at age 49, and just a tremendous loss of one of the most, you know, influential and unique rappers out there.
And MF Doom doesn't die. He crosses over because his impact on hip hop art and culture in general are still felt to this day from everything that he did. somebody who I'm sure, if I remembered the years that we remembered, I'm sure that came up on Remember Some Years, put out a number of stone cold classics during that time period. Somebody who, you know, ushered in a new era of hip hop in the early 2000s and, you know, really helped bridge the gap and offer an alternative in a lot of ways to much of the hip hop in those early 2000s that was available, and helped hip hop transition to being a really vital modern art form that it is today.
It was good to go back and listen to Mad Villainy, but also very sad for that to be the reason to do it.
I don't feel like I'd ever like forgotten about MF Doom. You know, it was one of those things where people talked about, you know, revisiting the music, and I feel like it was something that I was still listening to fairly often. But I did think about the time that I went to go see Doom live, and it was like, and I seriously do not know if I actually saw MF Doom live. It was like December 21st or something, I want to say 2006, and he was my favorite rapper at the time, my favorite artist excluding nobody. At the time, he was playing Chop Suey, like a crazy sold out Chop Suey. And we like got there, fought our way to the front of the stage. We're waiting, saw the openers or whatever, and time was just passing, right? And it was like, it's been an hour since the last artist went on. And you look at the set list, and of course there's like a printed set list, and it's like MF Doom 11 p.m. And you're like, great. Oh, that seems reasonable. And then it's like 11:30, 11:45, 12, 12:30. And you're like, I don't know if this is going to happen. I don't know if Doom is going to be here. And then eventually, like an hour and a half late, Doom comes out, obviously wearing the mask, does this incredible like 25-minute set. And it just is stone cold every single second, top to bottom, the most hyped crowd. The only other time I saw a crowd that hyped was seeing KRS-One in the exact same spot. Was like those two artists, which really shouts to Chop Suey in the early 2000s for being the home of hip hop in Seattle. Seeing those two artists, whereas like, you know, I was used to being at Blue Scholar shows and stuff like that, like, or other sort of like indie quote unquote hip hop. And they're like, put your hands in the air or whatever. KRS-One does not tell you to put your hands in the air. You put your hands in the air, right? Same with MF Doom. Like MF Doom is not concerned with what you're doing. You're doing it because MF there is doing it to you. And it was an incredible show. Whether it was actually MF Doom or not, no one knows, but it doesn't matter. It was worth it just to see him. And I still buried somewhere in this house, have the Live from Planet X t-shirt, size probably XL, because that was all that they had left.
It was MF Doom in your heart, and that's what matters.
That's all that matters, absolutely.
All right, let's get into our regular topic, starting with our NBA Seattle update, sponsored by Pagliacci Pizza.
I love that that's a regular update now.
It's back because Pagliacci is getting a lot of buzz, and so is NBA expansion.
There we go.
On the Bill Simmons podcast last week, where, you know, he brought up that he has, you know, been speculating about expansion for a period of time is a potential solution to the financial losses the NBA has suffered during the COVID-19 pandemic. His guest and my colleague, Jackie McMullen, raised questions about the viability of Climate Pledge Arena as an NBA arena. Let's listen to that clip.
All right, so I'll play devil's advocate. Do you think that arena that they're playing hockey in Seattle is an NBA-ready arena?
Well, here's the thing. If you're Bezos and you have a gajillion dollars and people are kind of turning on you, wouldn't a great way to win some people back be to bring the Seattle Supersonics expansion franchise?
Yeah, but you got to do something about that arena, because the people I've talked with have told me that arena is not an NBA-ready arena. And I don't know how much money and time it costs to get that ready.
So asked about this on Twitter, Tim Leiwicki from Oakview Group, who is on Twitter, I discovered that over the weekend. It's a very interesting place, Tim Leiwicki's Twitter, hit back, said, quote, "So don't know her," which obviously he knows Jackie McMullen. She's the legend. She's a Hall of Famer. "Never talked to us on arena. checked with folks we do talk with at NBA who have seen plans. So let's see, never seen arena plans, never talked to us, didn't talk to NBA folks. She is wrong, and we already spent more time on a bad report than we should have. I mean, I think it's very possible that, I have no idea who Jackie McMullen talked to. I haven't asked her about this. It's very possible that she's talking to a different group of people than Tim Leiwicki is about this. I mean, we've heard concerns raised in the past. My colleague Brian Windhorst wrote about this a few years ago in terms of the Seattle situation when there was the final game at Key Arena and the preseason game with the Warriors coming here, and concerns that league sources raised about the financial situation for a team that would be coming in as a tenant, potentially, if it's not co-owned, of Oakview Group and the second team in after the NHL. Now, Leiwicki was asked about this on Twitter by @SonicsMan back in December. His response, considering spending close to $1.2 billion on new arena, and we have built in NBA home visiting locker rooms, media broadcast positions, add that we have negotiated every suite deal and sponsor deal to allow for separate NBA upside, lease deal is top 25% for NBA. Which, by the way, is the first time that I recall seeing that $1.2 billion figure. It's now the cost of the arena has more than doubled from the original $564 million projection.
Of course it has. Okay, so let's just say that these sources that Jackie McMullen is talking to, these are actual conversations that are happening. Obviously, we don't know the inner workings of the NBA. Does this bring into question both the idea of expansion and expansion to Seattle?
I still think that, first off, we can talk about Leiwicki being this public and aggressive is another indicator that, expansion seems to be happening, because in the past, his tone has been very clearly, look, we're not going to get ahead of the NBA. We don't know when they're going to be expand, but we're going to be ready. And his tone has changed on that. Something he tweeted over the week to Simply Seattle at Sonics Forever on Twitter, 2021, the year we must turn our attention to bringing Sonics back to Seattle. For 41 years, this community was there for franchise. Now we must make our case to NBA that we have an opportunity to do the right thing. We will have one of the best arenas in the world. Time to fix this.
So they're being very public about this, right? And do you think that there's a chance, just trying to peer behind the curtain, that possibly the city of Seattle has been told that the NBA is looking at expansion? They're considering expansion, and Tim Leiwicki doesn't know what that process is going to look like. Possibly none of us know what that process is going to look like, but there might need to be a little bit of pitching that's done. This isn't going to be grandfathered into this particular arena.
Yeah, I mean, now the one thing to say, go back to the original conversation, is the quip we played from Adam Silver last week on The Jump with Rachel Nichols. He talked about how tough it was to leave Seattle, and that the reason they did it is because the arena wasn't NBA caliber, and that now there was an arena. So that's I think very good news for Climate Pledge Arena and the idea of a team playing there. But we don't know what an expansion process might look like. We don't know for sure there's going to be an expansion process at all. But would it be a case where, they're setting a certain price and then taking bids from various ownership groups? Would they select the cities ahead of time? Are they pitting cities against each other? Or is there going to be open bidding? So, it's a case of different potential Seattle ownership groups. Who's willing to pay the most? I think all of those are open questions. And depending on which of those play out, they might be better or worse for, Oakview Group sitting here with an existing NBA-ready arena.
Do you think there are other viable bidders aside from somebody affiliated with Oakview Group? Like, is that obviously we talk about the Chris Hansen Group.
I mean, they haven't gone anywhere.
If they win a bid for a team, can they build the arena?
I mean, it's tough because of the fact that it's kind of a catch-22 situation. You can't build the arena without the team, and you have a tough time getting the team without the arena.
But, and what would the timeline be for something like that? Does it get pushed farther out? Because the arena's Climate Pledge Arena has a roof, is being built. It's ready to play sports within this year.
I don't think the timetable would be an issue there.
Okay.
So.
All right.
We'll see. We'll continue to monitor the situation.
I mean, look, from our perspective, we just want basketball, right? Like, it doesn't really matter it matters what the process looks like. But I think the most important piece is getting basketball back to Seattle. And it, I think the quote from Jackie Mack, when we heard it, dampened the situation a little bit, right? It slowed some of the steam on the train. And I think hearing that maybe instead of hearing that the expansion steam is slowing, it might just be a question about the arena itself, makes me feel a little bit better. Because again, no skin in the game for either.
Again, there's nothing that has been said or has happened, you know, that has been done in the past couple of weeks or the past week since we recorded that has dampened my expectation about expansion.
Okay. That's great. That's all we care about. I've made a bold prediction and I need that bold prediction to come true.
A lot of people make bold predictions about me going to work for the Sonics, which we'll see. There's a lot of steps to get through there.
They have to. My bold prediction has to be right for that bold prediction to be right. So
that
I'll
is,
take
that
it.
That is true. All right, let's talk quickly about the Sounders. Sounder at Heart reported the Sounders are near completion of a new transfer deal to retain Joao Paulo. Will sign a new contract through 2023 with a club option for 2024 as part of that deal, which would keep him as a designated player. So kind of what we expected, but it would be good news anyway. Still some questions about what's going to happen with MLS in general for the 2021 season, because the league invoked the force majeure clause to reopen the CBA, the collective bargaining agreement with its players, for the third time in the past years, seeking additional financial modifications for the 2021 season to address lost revenue, with attendance likely to still be limited or non-existent depending on the market to start the season.
I declare force majeure. That's how the process looked, right?
It does, yes. That's a legal thing. You have to say it like that. Conversation still ongoing about the schedule for the 2021 season and whether that will be delayed at all.
But then again, aren't we all?
Wow. That's on the UW basketball front. UW women lost 60-50 on Friday at Colorado and then 84-61 on Sunday at Utah. With Tamia Sadler back in the lineup after missing a few weeks, the Huskies took a lead into the fourth quarter in Boulder and were down just one midway through that period. They went scoreless for the final 5:17 of the game as the Buffaloes pulled away. Sadler had 14 points in her first action since December 11th, but then struggled Sunday as the Huskies were swamped after halftime by Utah, which led by just 3 at the break. Huskies back home this weekend for another tough pair of games against number 7 Arizona on Friday. The Wildcats still ranked in the top 10 after suffering their first loss by 27 points at number 1 Stanford last weekend. Arizona State also receiving votes in the AP Bowl despite a 3-3 start to conference play, because all 3 of those losses came to top 10 teams.
It's wild.
Pac-12, very good at women's
basketball. It doesn't, I mean, they're not a bad team. It's just the schedule's so brutal.
It's not fun, especially playing everybody twice this year. UW men's basketball suffered an 80-53 loss on Thursday against Arizona, but did not lose on Saturday because the game was postponed due to COVID-19 spread on the Arizona State roster. Huskies shot just 31% from the field and 6 of 31, 19% from 3 against Arizona. Quade Green was the lone player to score more than 7 points for the Huskies, who were also destroyed on the offensive glass, with the Wildcats securing 47.5% of available offensive rebounds.
Half of offensive rebounds.
If you round up, yes. Huskies headed to the Bay Area this weekend. The Stanford game on Thursday will be played at Kaiser Permanente Arena in Santa Cruz due to Santa Clara County's COVID-19 restrictions. The Cardinal have played their 2 home games thus far this season in Santa Cruz. Stanford 2-1 so far in Pac-12 play, but dealing with injuries in the backcourt. Our old friend Dejon Davis hasn't played since suffering a leg injury in their win over Arizona in mid-December, and junior Bryce Wills left Monday's win at Oregon State with an ankle injury. Stanford still features freshman Zaire Williams, who is currently rated number 8 in the ESPN NBA draft top 100. On Saturday,
how did he get to Stanford? What transpired to make him go to Stanford?
Highest rated recruit in Stanford program history.
Wow. There we go.
Saturday presents the Huskies their best chance to get a win for a while as they play at Cal. The Bears are 0-4 so far in Pac-12 play, as well as a non-conference loss at Oregon State, similar to the Huskies playing Colorado in a neutral site game. that just one of their five wins so far has come over a team in the Pomeroy Top 200, though it was an impressive one. They beat San Francisco 72-70 on December 13th.
That's an impressive victory.
Yeah, USF's top 100. They played Gonzaga tough on Saturday.
Wow, okay.
They beat Virginia. Junior Matt
Bradley. West Coast Conference is better than the Pac-12.
I'm not going to go that far. USF is certainly better than a lot of teams in the Pac-12. They would finish at worst like 8th in the Pac-12. Junior Matt Bradley from Cal ranks third in the Pac-12 in scoring at 17.8 points per game. UW football.
Are we just moving on here? You don't feel like the complete futility? I mean, it's just like, all right, it's like the OL Reign update. Like, we're going to have to start remembering some years this spring, right? Like,
yeah. I said it last week.
How many searches for Seattle's best can we do?
Did not get any feedback on that from the listener. For the record.
Yeah, we're going to have to search for Seattle's best hookah bar pretty soon. Like I feel like the steam for Mike Hopkins is not looking great. We're nearing a point where if they finish this season as, aren't there some metrics that have UW as the worst Power 5 school?
No. Oh, I don't know. I mean, some metrics probably. KenPom, they are not anywhere close to that. They're still right in that preseason ranking to not even being worse than Wazoo.
That is wild to me. That I cannot.
No, Wazoo did finally pass them on Saturday with their double OT loss to Arizona.
Wazoo looks pretty good too.
They do. I agree. I mean, the Huskies did play Oregon pretty tough, and Oregon is probably the best team in the conference.
I think there are legit questions about the direction of the program long term. Right
for
now,
sure.
And I wouldn't be surprised if Mike Hopkins, if this season continued the way it's going right now, which I have no reason to suspect it's not going to continue the way it's going right now, I would not be surprised if this was Mike Hopkins' last season as UW head coach.
Yeah, that's why I made that bold prediction. It was a good bold prediction.
It's a solid bold prediction. But I every week that passes, I think the conversation becomes more and more clear. The futility is more and more clear from the program.
I mean, the thing is, there's no conversation. That's the thing.
It's nothing. They do not matter. They absolutely
do not
matter.
Because they are off the radar screen right now in a situation where there are no professional sports happening. You know, the Seahawks are still playing into the UWC is obviously the start of it. But after they finish, there's no professional sports going on in the winter in Seattle. And we got one coming in 2021 with the Kraken. And it sounds like there could be an NBA. The Sonics could be part of it a couple of years after that. I don't know how UW men's basketball breaks through in this market in that situation.
Husky football.
Comings and goings at the quarterback position. Ethan Garbers, who had placed his name in the transfer portal last week, announced he's going to transfer to UCLA, but the Huskies added a grad transfer. Patrick O'Brien from Colorado State, second consecutive year that they've added a grad transfer. O'Brien will enroll for the winter quarter and be available for spring practices, giving UW a second scholarship quarterback available for the spring if there's a spring high school season in Seattle, which not many on, and incoming freshman Sam Heward opts to play that instead of participate with UW.
Don't do that, Sam Heward.
O'Brien started his career in Nebraska before transferring to Colorado State. He posted a 58.3 QBR last season while splitting time, and 55.1 is a full-time starter most of 2019. For comparison, Dylan Morris had a 69.9 QBR last season. So I think the odds that, you know, O'Brien is going to come in here and win the starting job are pretty low, but this is still a really important addition for the Huskies.
Yeah, this is an interesting one. Also a quarterback who's played in three different conferences and three different – Colorado State's in the Big 12? No.
Colorado State's in the Mountain West.
Still having played in the Big 10, the Mountain West, and the Pac-12 now. That is three pretty big conferences there for Patrick O'Brien. I wonder if there was even more to this decision, if there was some sort of – conversation about him possibly coming on as a grad assistant after. You know, I think from his perspective, it doesn't make a ton of sense. You know, I suppose if something were to happen to Dylan Morris, knock on wood, maybe they wouldn't want to burn a red shirt for Sam Heward after that, but it's pretty clear that Dylan Morris is the starter as long as he's going to be here and as long as he's effective, and that Sam Heward is the heir to that position.
Well, I think the important thing we should talk about here is like the situation that didn't come up last week when we were talking about the Huskies depth chart after these transfers at quarterback is like the nightmare scenario is, I mean, nightmare is strong, but like the worst case scenario would have been Sam Heward comes in and wins the starting job right away and Dylan Morris decides to transfer so that he doesn't have to sit out, you know, miss 2 years, you know, yeah, depending on what the transfer years at that rules are at that point. And then you could have been left with one scholarship quarterback on the roster. So that's where O'Brien would really come in huge.
Definitely depth. I'd be pretty surprised if that happened, just given what Dylan Morris did this season. I mean, the sample size was minuscule, but Dylan Morris was quite good. Who knows? We've seen it play out. Like, I mean, we saw Trevor Lawrence take the job from a veteran quarterback at Clemson. If Sam Heward is that good, then that's what will happen.
If you want to go the freshman, redshirt freshman situation, Jacob Eason at Georgia, where he got replaced by Jake Fromm and then transferred to UW. So we've seen it
the
before.
The difference between Dylan Morris and Jacob Eason is that Dylan Morris is good.
Oh, poor Jacob Eason.
About 15 points of completion percentage. But we'll see. I mean, obviously having depth at quarterback is a good thing. You know, at the same time, you can't fault Ethan Garbers and, you know, the rest of these quarterbacks that have transferred because they're not going to have an opportunity. Like this makes sense. Seeing within Pac-12 transfer for a quarterback is a little surprising.
I think it's going to become more common going forward, especially as the transfer restrictions are, you know, limited. We'll see whether the, you know, unlimited one-time transfer rule gets brought in next season.
Hell yeah.
But
I want all transfers. Every team goes to a playoff, all transfers, and the players are paid. That's my league.
You want in-game transfers?
Yeah.
Like if things go poorly in the first half, you just transfer to the other team for the second half.
Or it should be complete autonomy, right? Like you should be able to do whatever the hell you want. I could transfer to whatever college I want to go to, right? I mean, if I'm a student.
You couldn't though. Because you couldn't get in those colleges.
Not anymore. I could have gotten into Oregon. I would say at least 60% of Pac-12 colleges. If you want to run this through right now, obviously UW, Wazoo, Oregon State, Arizona State, and List.
Well, that's I mean, this is part of the reason you might not get, because you said 60%, right?
Which is not a clean number, but
there are 12 schools now in the Pac-12, not 10.
Oh, I think I could have also gotten into Colorado and Utah. This was when I was in college. I'm not looking at the current Pac-12 rules. This was when I was in college.
You couldn't get into UW, but of the current situation.
In fact, I'm right. Didn't I say 60%? And I named 6 out of the 10 Pac-10 schools.
I see what you were saying there.
Yes. Yeah, I'm old. Add those other two, though. I could have gotten either of those.
You're part of that when I was your age, the Pac-12 and 10 teams group.
I could have gone almost anywhere I wanted in the Pac-12 except for the good schools. But I'm saying I could have transferred to I could have gone to UW for 1 year. I'm not sure how transfer rules work, and gone to Oregon the next year. And that's the way it should be for student athletes, whether they're paid or not. It's egregious that that's not the case.
I agree.
So let Ethan Garbers go play at UCLA. And if he wants to come back, he can come back.
We may see him next season. We'll see. All right. Let's talk about the Seahawks, who have an opponent for the playoffs. They have a seed. They have the third seed in the NFC, despite their 26-23 win Sunday versus the 49ers in Glendale, Arizona. We're unable to move up as the Green Bay Packers and New Orleans Saints both pretty comfortably and in the end won their games, despite some early scares, I guess. So it's going to be, for the second time in 3 weeks, the Seahawks and Rams at Lumen Field, except we don't know who's going to be playing quarterback for the Rams.
I think we have a pretty confident idea of who's going to be playing quarterback for the Rams?
I don't have a strong prior about who's going to be playing quarterback for the Rams.
Really?
Yeah.
Have you seen any chatter this week that has indicated that Jared Goff's going to be starting? Have you seen any positive conversation?
I mean, the tone was more optimistic, I think, before Ian Rappaport's report on, I guess that was today, earlier Monday.
I think we should, for
Goff to play this weekend.
We should approach this conversation as if John Wolford is starting, because I think that is the most likely scenario. It's not 100%, obviously. Jared Goff hasn't been ruled out, but I think the most likely scenario in this moment on Monday, January 4th, with Slack down, that John Wolford is going to be the starting quarterback for the LA Rams on Saturday afternoon.
I think it's the most likely scenario. I do think it's like 60, you know, two-thirds at this point.
We could give percentage chances of victory with either quarterback, but I think that when discussing the game, we should discuss it as if John Wolford will be starting.
We should probably, before we get to discussing the game, discuss some Seahawks news, though. Starting with the Lions' interest in John Schneider. The aforementioned Ian Rappaport of NFL.com reported the Lions' interest on Sunday, describing it as, quote, a potential blockbuster move. Schneider is under contract through the 2022 draft. Pro Football Talk reported that such a move would require Seahawks agreement because Schneider has, quote, primary authority over football decisions, and therefore it would not be a promotion if he took a GM job elsewhere. Pro Football Talk further reports that Schneider, quote, isn't paid at the top of the GM market and is, quote, believed to be prepared to become a free agent in 2022 if he doesn't get a market value deal from the Seahawks. For his part, Schneider called it, quote, an interesting morning when asked about it on the pregame show, but emphasized how much he and his family like Seattle and the strength of the organization.
I sometimes wonder about that when you see these posts from people where it's like, a name that you're not thinking about is blah, 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 right? Mike Kafka, where you're like, all of a sudden, it's just like, oh, damn, you wake up one morning as Mike Kafka and you're like, I'm getting interest. I feel like that has to be part of it, where it's like, wait, people are asking around about me? I'm sure that there must have been an inquiry to John Schneider's agent from the Lions to see if this is even a conversation that they would engage with. I hate to bring this up because it's just a ridiculous thing that comes on the TV after Sunday Night Football when I forget to change the channel, but I was watching the fifth quarter yesterday, love Walt Jones, but John Clayton was on and talking about this report, and the way that John Clayton framed the entire conversation was basically John Schneider is going to get a lucrative extension with the Seahawks, and I think that this report has more to do with that than it does with him actually leaving the Seahawks to become GM of the Detroit Lions.
As many people pointed out, as my beer overflows here, the one job that John Schneider clearly...
There's something wanted. So excessive about hearing as my beer overflows here.
I don't know how it foamed up so much. The job that
their parties were endless. They went into the hours. Their beer overflowed. They recorded the Pelton cast deep into the night. Their overs, their unders, every over hit. The beer overflowed.
Wow. Our cup runneth over. Holy grail. The one job that John Schneider was clearly interested in was the Packers job. He previously had written into his contract the ability to go leave, to go get the Packers job. And then it came open in 2018. And he didn't take it. He stayed in Seattle.
According to, again, John Clayton on that broadcast, the Seahawks, even though that was written into his agreement, still blocked him from going.
Well, it was a previous contract, I think, is my understanding.
That next contract. Kind of fucked up when you think about it. I can't imagine signing a contract and being like, but if this one, it's like, you know.
I can understand it.
Like the Packers were on the list.
Really interested in.
Yeah, John Schneider made his list. He laminated it, and the Packers were the team. it's a little bit ridiculous to think about the Packers being the one team. I don't see this happening. I mean, the question was brought up by a lot of people of, would this matter? And, you know. I think, and we'll talk about this when we talk about John Wolford, I think there is an interest among the football fan, as I have observed, to think that the grass is greener on the other side. as one would say.
Just football fans. Nobody else feels that way.
And I think that John Schneider has been a very successful GM with the Seahawks. And also, it's very difficult. I think people don't realize, imagine starting a new job, how long it takes for you in a new job to really get comfortable with what you're doing. And it's at minimum a year.
I'm still trying to get comfortable at ESPN.
And I think that people really underestimate that. Like, there has to be a legit... I was thinking of this with Cliff Kingsbury as coach of the Cardinals. And it's like, is Cliff Kingsbury going to be the coach of the Cardinals in 2 years? Probably not. But also, it's just kind of hard to change your entire organization in that way and to get to know another person and for Pete to develop a relationship with somebody else. You know, there's probably people internally that they would promote, but like, it's Pete and John is who it is. It would have to be a pretty impressive offer, I think, for both John Schneider to look at it and say, this is something that's worth moving away from a perennial playoff team, from having Russell Wilson, from having the infrastructure, from having the relationships, to also on the Seahawks end, to even allowing him to do it and saying that they would want to find another person who is in charge of player personnel. And I think on both sides, it just doesn't make sense. There are situations where it's like, you know, an assistant GM is clearly looking to move up. That's the need for power. People always talk about, you know, he'd have final say on player personnel. And it's like, is final say in player personnel that much more valuable with the Lions than possibly not final say is with the Seahawks plus 9 years of history? You know, like, as far as we know, there's not any sort of rift between Pete and John. I'm sure that there's always a tension, you know, within these sorts of relationships. And I don't question that. Anytime that you have close relationships, there's going to be a certain tension. But at the end of the day,
maybe even like when you have a brother,
just always, you know, if you have a professional relationship with somebody that you work very closely to, you love that person, you work very closely to them, and sometimes you're going to disagree on things, you know, I don't, and sometimes you're going to be frustrated. But at the end of the day, is that enough? Is that need for having the final say enough to say to yourself that I'm going to go work for the Detroit fucking Lions, right? And I just am not sure. And I think, again, to come back to what John Clayton was saying, I think it is very likely that we see a John Schneider with a new deal to continue his position with the Seahawks.
I think so too, is the ombudsman. I would also reject that as a bold prediction for 2021.
It would just be such a boring bold prediction. John Schneider bold prediction. So I think that is the most likely outcome.
If it was John Schneider goes to another team, that would be a pretty good bold prediction, actually.
Before this report, yes.
Even after, I still take it.
On the No, rejected.
Oh wow, made you, but. Jamal Adams left the game against San Francisco with a shoulder injury, the opposite shoulder of the one he injured earlier this season. Pete Carroll was initially optimistic about his chances of playing against the Rams postgame, but less committal Monday morning on his weekly ESPN 710.
You know what we're going to call that? Pete Carroll pulled.
A Pete Carroll.
When he was optimistic, there were a bunch of people in the tweet. Bob Condotta tweeted it. And then every single person did the like Denzel like few meme or whatever. And it was just like, y'all, I don't think you're familiar with Pete Carroll. This doesn't mean anything. Pete Carroll being optimistic about somebody playing, it could mean the spectrum from they're guaranteed to play versus their career's over. Like this statement meant nothing. What he said today means a lot more than what he said yesterday. And being non-committal about it today means Jamal Adams is not playing this game on Saturday.
This season is over. No, I don't know. We'll see on that one.
No, but I think I would, again, similar to the John Wolford conversation, I would put my priors at less than 50% here.
Jaron Reed's status also uncertain due to an oblique injury. So I do expect to get Brandon Schell back after he missed Sunday's game, not due to the injury he had previously had, which he was set to return from, but due to a close contact who tested positive for COVID-19. Assuming he does not test positive, he would then clear that quarantine well in time for the game.
And can we look at the timing of this Brandon Schell injury? Because I think that Brandon Shell's injury lines up pretty closely with when the Seahawks offense started regressing.
It was week 11. He played 40% of the snaps against the Jets and then has missed the last two games. Or last two.
That's
games.
It? Wasn't he injured prior?
He had previously missed two games, yes. So he's the 40% of the snaps against the Jets were the only snaps he's played since.
Came back for a period of time where the Seahawks crushed the Jets.
Yes. So he missed the Giants game, notably. I mean, I do think Brandon Shell will help a lot if he's healthy.
I mean, how many of those games are games where we felt like the Seahawks offense didn't look like the Seahawks offense? And how many games happened before then that we felt like the Seahawks offense didn't look like the Seahawks offense? Most of the games that we felt that during that time period have been, and they're probably unrelated, but I'm just saying that I don't think they're
unrelated. I just don't think that's 100% of it.
It could be a part of it. The Brandon Shell's health is a huge factor. And also Mike Iupati, the offensive line's health is a huge factor in this. You can see Russ back there, right? You can see him on these plays and he doesn't look comfortable. He's bailing from the pocket so early.
I feel like Jordan Simmons has played well enough that the left guard situation is not a big differentiator. But right tackle, I agree, is particularly when Cedric Oboye has also been out and they've been forced to, you know, way down the depth chart.
I think it is a bigger factor than people are giving credence to. How about that? I think that Brandon Shell playing is more important than Jamal Adams potentially not playing.
I don't know about that. We'll see. Ryan Neal's actually played pretty well when he's played in place of Jamal Adams this season. As you mentioned, Iupati also expected back from the neck injury this week, so Seahawks should have a full offensive line.
I mean, going into the playoffs with a full offensive line is a huge thing. And I'm going to, again, giant knock on wood here. Is that getting picked up on the microphone?
It is, yes.
The Seahawks' health has been fairly good. They are going into the playoffs with a pretty healthy roster. And that's something that we have not been able to say a lot of seasons heading to the playoffs. And it's one thing that gives me a little bit more hope as we go into these playoffs, especially depending on, you know, what Jamal Adams and Jaron Reed, I'm maybe a little bit less hopeful in. But if Jamal were to play in this game, they look like a pretty healthy team offensively and defensively, and having that full offensive line, and Brent Shaw has put a great season. You know, I think we have a little bit more of a reason to assume that the offense may bounce back to first half of the season levels rather than continue where they've been.
All right, should we talk about the Rams?
We always do.
We have a lot lately. To go back to Goff, he had surgery last week on the broken finger he suffered against the Seahawks, missed Sunday's game. Was able to throw apparently on Sunday, but, you know, again, that report from Ian Rappaport that it will be challenging for him to play this weekend, citing the cold in Seattle is one factor for that. So the weather may be doing the Seahawks some benefit.
They've never talked to a person from the Midwest before, because the only thing that a person from the Midwest talks about is how warm it is in Seattle, how we've never seen cold in our entire life before. So talk to any human being from fucking Chicago, and that's the only thing that they can talk about is how warm it is in Seattle and how we've never once seen cold in our entire lives.
Jared Goff, you'll note, the listener will note, is not from Chicago and has spent his last, what, nine seasons in either the Bay Area or in LA.
Never once been to Chicago.
I mean, I'm sure he's been there. It's not his default. John Wolford made his first NFL start in Sunday's clinching win for the Rams, playoff clinching win over Arizona, going 22 of 38 for 231 yards with an interception on his first pass attempt. Wolford presents much more of a rushing threat than Goff. He had 56 yards on six carries, five of which went for at least 9 yards. And in a large part because of those rushes, managed a better EPA per play than Goff averaged this season, although his completion percentage over expectation from Arby's DM.com, -4.5. So pretty weak there in that regard. And the Sean McVay offense typically lends itself to high expected completion percentage.
And open receivers. I mean, you know, Jared Goff did not play a game this year, I think, without Cooper Kupp. And John Wolford's first ever start of his career was without Cooper Kupp. So it's a question. You know, I mean, I think that Cooper Kupp is a completion percentage over expectation beast, but this was not a good game from John Wolford. You know, the rushing sample, it's still very small. You're looking at that like it is. I'm telling you, like, what about this game to you?
The eye test.
You are highly... You didn't watch this game. There's no eye test.
Oh, I watched the highlights.
That
John Wolford rushing is legit. Like, he moves.
How many points did the Rams offense score?
Not that many points. As many points as the Rams defense.
Was it really? No.
Yeah, it was.
Then they scored 12? And the defense... Oh, the defense got a safety as well.
Yeah, you're dead right. They did. The defense scored 9 points. The offense scored 9 points if you're crediting the extra point, which I think you should here.
Yeah, to the defense. Okay, so the defense scored 9 points in this game. Like, yes, the Rams won. That doesn't mean that John Wolford played a good game.
He played a fine game. He was fine. You dispute his fineness? I mean, first off, a lot of the problem...
Still 27th in DR this week. Like, I'm sorry that you completely invalidate this because you pray at the feet of the QBR god, but like, this is...
I pray at the feet of the EPA god.
It was not a good game that John Wolford played. Like, if you were to tell me that that was the exact game that he was going to play in Seattle on Sunday, and I could just pencil that in, pen that in, sign me up. 21 of 38. What was his yards per attempt?
6.1. I mean, I don't disagree with any of that, but he did certainly play better than Jared Goff did the week before.
And the other factor with this is we'll talk about the running game. The running game has to do with what John Wolford did here as well. These two things are inextricably linked to each other. And the fact that the Cardinals defense did not have to worry about John Wolford at all meant that they were able to dial in on the run game. And I'll tell you who loves a scenario like that. And that is, he pulls a Pete Carroll when he's talking about injury. And that is Mr. Peter Clay Carroll, who loves the scenario. If you can stop a run game, look, don't tell Brian Daboll. Like, he is ready to stop the run. Do not pass on him. But Mr. Peter Clay Carroll, if he can key in on stopping the run, he's going to key in on stopping the run.
The only thing that is loved more than Peter Clay Carroll loves stopping the run is us calling him Peter Clay Carroll. That's the only thing.
Is Peter Clay Carroll doing the run?
Oh, no. Well, as you mentioned, with Daryl Henderson Jr. sidelined by the high ankle sprain he suffered against the Seahawks that put him on IR, Cam Akers came back early and struggled badly on the ground Sunday, running 21 times for 34 yards. Malcolm Brown got just 3 carries, although those went for 20 yards. And as a result, the Rams' 4.8 yards per play were their third fewest in a game this season. Akers did have...
What were the two lower games? Do you know?
I don't know that off the top of my head.
They had... I mean, I there's a lot of pretty ugly Rams games. They had some great games in there. I mean, it could have been the Seahawks one in Seattle. Could have been the Jets loss. Could have been that Dolphins loss. That was pretty brutal.
There are options, yes. You didn't even mention the Jets game, did you?
I did, yes.
Okay. Yeah. Akers did have 4 catches for a team-high 52 yards, with Kupp unavailable after testing positive for COVID-19, as reported by the busy Ian Rappaport. Jordan Rodriguez of The Athletic reported that Kupp, as well as Michael Brockers, who also missed Sunday's game, would be able to return for Saturday if he does not develop COVID-19 symptoms during the course of his self-isolation. In Kupp's absence, rookie Van Jefferson was targeted a team-high 8 times and had 4 catches for 50 yards. Jim Nantz mentioned on the CBS broadcast that his comfort level was quite high with Wolford because of the time they spent together on the second team in practice.
Horseshit, but okay. It's just, it's a talking point. It's whatever. He was the receiver who was out there. That's
there are other receivers out there. They still have Robert Woods.
You know what? The defense was a lot more comfortable defending Robert Woods because he was Robert Woods. Like quarterbacks are comfortable throwing whoever's open. This is one thing that I have always thought was stupid.
I'd like to see a study of it.
How many years has Russell Wilson played with Tyler Lockett? But he seems awfully comfortable throwing the ball to DK Metcalf. He's every receiver is comfortable to throwing to whatever talking point you want them to throw to.
There's big difference between that and who Geno Smith is comfortable throwing to in the 15 plays a week or whatever it is he runs in practice.
I don't believe that. I absolutely do not believe this at all. He was one of two receivers. He had the most targets because Cooper Kupp was out.
It's not one of two receivers. Again, Josh Reynolds is in the mix. They have tight ends. They play multiple tight ends.
What you mean to say is Cooper Kupp was out, so Van Jefferson had the most targets of his career. It doesn't matter. We don't need to get into this. This is a waste of time.
As we mentioned, the Rams,
we could be talking about how great our over-unders are.
Well, as we mentioned, the Rams won Sunday's game with defense, holding Arizona to 4.4 yards per play, which was also the Cardinals' third fewest of the season. They couldn't get anything going on the ground either, running 18 times for 48 yards. And after replacing the injured Kyler Murray, backup Chris Stoeveler threw a crushing pick six to Troy Hill in Rams territory late in the first half. That was part of that 9-point output for the Rams defense. The only touchdown the defense allowed came with a short field after Wolford's interception.
And so when we thought we were going to get a Streveler versus Wolford matchup for a playoff spot on Sunday, I went and took a gander at Chris Streveler's stats with, Ottawa. What is the Ottawa team?
I don't know if I remember Ottawa. They're not the Red Black, are they? Someone else is the Red Black, right?
The Red Black?
That's a thing, isn't it?
Somehow that sounds racist. But Chris Streveler in the CFL, and the season that he played in the CFL.
Oh, it is Ottawa, the Red Blacks.
There we go.
There you go.
Is that who Chris Streveler played for, though?
I don't know.
Can we confirm that part, too? You correctly named the Ottawa team nickname.
Apparently there's a name controversy according to the autofill on Google.
Ottawa football team. Chris Streveler had more interceptions.
You were wrong, though. Winnipeg Bombers.
Okay, that's what I was going to say. I knew it was Ottawa or Winnipeg, right? I knew it wasn't Saskatoon. But the Winnipeg Blue Bombers, with the Winnipeg Blue Bombers, Chris Streveler threw more interceptions than touchdowns in that season.
That seems not great.
So this is not like – this is a very bad backup quarterback, right? And
probably.
The Rams defense scored more points than their offense did. Like, we're not comparing Russell Wilson to Chris Streveler here, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Like, the Rams defense is always terrifying. But if we're using the 1 week sample size of playing against Chris Streveler and the Cardinals, I think we have to throw that out. Like, this was not a game. They weren't playing on even ground here. And the Seahawks are coming in at pretty close to full health, especially on offense. They're going to average more than 4.4 yards per play.
Is this what we talk at the point where we talk about the Seahawks offense for the first three quarters on Sunday?
Well,
because it was bad.
They earned every single one of those 3 yards they gained in the third quarter.
We're pinning this all on Cedric Ogbuehi now?
I honestly can't tell why the Seahawks offense is bad. I don't know if you have a read on this. I mean, obviously you don't. If you did, I don't know.
I have some analysis.
Okay, let's hear it.
It actually does not quite say what I thought it would. I decided to go in NFL Fast R. Shouts to third brother Ben Baldwin. And look at deep passes in terms of air yards. And I settled on 30 air yards as the cutoff point. So this season, Russell Wilson's 14 completions and 35 attempts of at least 30 air yards, both tied with Aaron Rodgers for the most in the NFL. Overall, NFL quarterbacks completed 32% of such attempts this season. Russell Wilson, along with Rodgers, was at 40%. But during the first 4 weeks of the season, the full let Russ cook period, Wilson was 6 of 8 on passes with at least 38 air yards. Through week 9, he was 12 of 18 which means that since then, he is 2 of 17 completing those passes. That is the gambler's fallacy come to life.
But it's some regression to the mean. Like,
but that's 2 of 17 is below the mean. I just told you the mean was 32%. The mean is like 5 or 6.
Through those first 4 weeks, every single time the ball left the screen, it was a touchdown. Or DK Metcalf dropped the ball before the end zone. Like, there was that was it, right? Every single pass. I mean, you remember that bomb that David Moore went up and got at the near the end zone? You're just like, damn, how did he catch that? And it was like, yeah, this was the first 4 weeks of 2020. This is something we'll be talking about in 5 years, right? And we'll say this could be the Seahawks offense. That was weeks 1 through 4 of the Seahawks offense. It's not going to continue forever. The question was, why were they so off, right? You saw those deep balls, and you don't even think about the Russ deep balls anymore, right? Our brains have been conditioned. You see him throw a deep ball and you're like, maybe no. Okay, it's 20 yards away from the receivers. It seems like for whatever reason, maybe they just aren't on the practice squad together enough. The balls are going the wrong directions of the receivers often. There were a couple of them this weekend where it's like, man, Russ threw that into space where DK or Tyler Lockett could have gone to get it, and they weren't anywhere near it. And I think part of it is Cedric Oboye. Like, the time that Russ is having in the pocket, the most important thing you can give a quarterback like Russell Wilson is time to throw the ball. And the most important thing that you can give a quarterback like Russell Wilson when he's trying to throw passes 30 yards down the field, 30 air yards down the field, is time to throw the ball. I watched a clip today of some of the best Trevor Lawrence throws, right? And it was just like, bless the timeline of Trevor Lawrence throws. That, yeah. And I was like, damn, he had 45 seconds to make every single one of these throws. Yeah, he's roasting Pitt. Great, Trevor Lawrence. Wait until you're on the Jacksonville Jaguars. Like, it's not going to be the same. And when you don't have time, those throws are a hell of a lot harder, right? Aaron Rodgers, if you're not playing behind the Packers line, those throws are harder to make. And I think Russ got a little bit antsy behind this line. You know, he got what you would describe as happy feet or whatever. He was not even scrambling a little bit more. Just he was breaking the pocket a little bit sooner and rushing some of those throws. Russell Wilson with a clean pocket is a scary thrower. Russell Wilson, when pressured, is one of the best deep passers in NFL history. And I think that that's not what we've seen the second half of the season. And we can't give too much of that weight to, you know, Jordan Simmons or Cedric Oboye or whatever, right? Like, there's more to it than that. But if they can get, and also they're going to be facing Aaron Donald this weekend, there's not going to be time. But if they can give him a half second more, if they could give him just a little bit more, can they complete one of these passes, right? Because it feels like they haven't in a while hit something big. I mean, you're talking as 2 of 17 since week 9. So if they can hit one of these passes, that's a huge deal.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it was the last time they played the Rams. We'll talk about that in a second. I mean, the one thing that really surprised me doing this research is my expectation going in is that the number of deep attempts would be way down, because of the fact that the Seahawks offense has gotten more conservative as Pete Carroll has placed this emphasis on ball security in the wake of the, you know, spate of turnovers midseason, including the trip to LA. And that really isn't the case. Like, they've thrown, the difference is one deep pass in weeks 10 through 17, you know, the final 8 games versus the first 8 games. So the deep attempts are still there. They're just not being completed. And some of that is probably, obviously, they were super lucky to complete so many the first half of the season.
6 of 8 on passes, 30 yards, 30 air yards.
That's not sustainable. But they've probably been somewhat unlucky in terms of their completions in the second half of the season, which, again, you're not like due for bad luck, but sometimes it does happen. So here's the bad news. Let's talk about the LA Rams on passes 30 air yards or more. LA opponents are 3 of 30 this season.
Wow.
With 2 interceptions when they throw the ball at least 30 yards in the air. Per StatHead.com, the Rams allowed just 38 plays of 28-plus yards this season, far and away the fewest in the NFL. Washington football team was second lowest at 47. Only one other team below 50 such plays allowed this season.
Who was that?
I don't remember who the third team was.
I'm surprised to Washington football team, because we think of them as a pass-rushing team, and obviously the Rams are both. There's Jalen Ramsey and there's Aaron Donald, right? Right. There's the surf and the turf with the Rams, but like,
which one is the surf and which is the, well, I guess Aaron Donald's for sure the turf, right?
Aaron Donald's the turf. The surf. Jalen Ramsey's the surf. But this is something that we had a lot of dialogue about over the offseason, which basically was pass rush is less important than the secondary. And to hear you talk about, and this is one stat, but this is a secondary stat that we're talking about. And I don't think that Washington's secondary is bad, but like this, seeing that their pass rush has influenced those balls, I think is important.
I think it's a philosophy stat more than as much as anything. So just two of those 20 plus yard plays went for touchdowns against the Rams. Every other team at least allowed at least five touchdowns of 20 plus yards. And notably, the Seahawks did have just two 20 yard plays in the two games against the Rams, long passes to Tyler Lockett and David Moore. But I mean, obviously the pass rush is a huge factor in this. Obviously Jalen Ramsey is a huge factor in this, but also I think it's a philosophy that Brandon Staley has brought in his first year as defensive coordinator. It was really interesting. Robert Mays, friend of the pod, had a piece on The Athletic last week about Staley's philosophy. And he was talking about a lot of the same things that Pete Carroll talks about in terms of preventing explosive plays. Yeah. But also he was saying how, no, you can't do that playing cover one or cover three with that, you know, single high safety, because there's too many crossing patterns that are able to take advantage of those. So they largely play two safeties back and try to have a numbers advantage in the passing game, and then just have been able to be very successful against the running game as well, despite not committing men to the box.
What Brandon Staley is saying is, look, if everybody has the best defensive player in football, you could play whatever defense you want.
They've been more successful under Brandon Staley than they were under the great Wade Phillips.
Have they beyond randomness better under Brandon Staley?
I mean, I don't know how to define beyond randomness better, because randomness is a lot, but
one cannot define randomness. It's a one game difference between the two, right? They were 9-7 last year, 10-6 this year. But I'm just saying, like,
it's a record. They are.
Where did they rank defensive DVOA last year versus this year?
Number four in defense DVOA this year. Last year they were.
Keep in mind, they did not have a full season of Ramsey last year.
No, they did not. Number nine last year.
I don't know if I can owe that to philosophy just yet. But like, sure, whatever. Teams that are considering hiring Brandon Staley as your fucking head coach. If you can hire Brandon Staley as your head coach and then give him Aaron Donald and only have him be responsible for half the field, enjoy. But it's a philosophy that works when you have somebody like that. The Seahawks basically, maybe Michael Bennett, and Pete Carroll's entire tenure have never had a pass rusher like Aaron Donald. And everything is a lot more simple when you do have a pass rusher like Aaron Donald. But I do personally, I feel like I've taken the blue pill or whatever on this as far as how defense should work. And somebody mentioned, I think this was Chris Collinsworth on Sunday Night Football, saying, bend but don't break, whatever you want to call it. Ow!
That's your Chris Collinsworth impression?
Look, Al! It's a little Bruce Springsteen. I personally, as a defensive philosophy, think keeping everything in front of you is the most important defensive philosophy. Make the other team use three downs, make the other team make mistakes. And trying to be perfect.
And come around on your philosophy.
Trying to be perfect on defense, stopping a team from doing everything, never works. It means that the other team is going to be very good at everything against you. But if you make the other team use third downs and use a lot of plays to beat you, that's going to end up with them at some point committing a turnover, kicking a field goal, punting, whatever. That is the philosophy that I feel like this season in football I have awoken to. And from your description, that's a defensive philosophy that both Brandon Staley and Pete Carroll subscribe to. And also, it's going to lead to an incredibly boring game on Sunday.
Oh, it's going to be very boring.
Saturday, excuse me.
Yeah.
Look, you saw the Giants game. You saw the Washington game. You saw the Eagles game. You saw the Rams game. You saw the 49ers game. And buckle up, motherfuckers, because here comes playoff football. Seahawks versus Rams, 13-9. Show me a 6-6 halftime score.
Oh, no.
That's what, unless Brandon Schell matters a lot. Because look, Brandon Schell played 40% of the snaps against the New York Jets, the surging New York Jets, except maybe against the Patriots this last weekend. The surging New York Jets. Brandon Schell played 40% of those snaps, and the Seahawks were the only team to really crush the Jets in the second half of the season.
I sure hope we took the under for the Jets.
Look, Lord, I cannot guarantee it. This could make a difference. There was some luck that happened in that game. Obviously, the missed field goals were ridiculous from the Jets, but I think this is going. It's going to be an incredibly close game, and I think it's an arm's length game for the Seahawks. It's a game where I don't want them to be with a 6-0 lead and think that's enough, because Pete Carroll, if his defense is playing well, will tell you that a 6-0 lead is enough, and I don't want that to be the case, because, you know, Tristan Vizcaino can hit 2 field goals like that. If they can have this at a 9-point lead, an 8-point lead for much of the game, I think that possibly could be enough. They just need a touchdown plus advantage for most of this game. They don't need to do a ton. They arms link the Rams, and they win this game on Saturday.
So we haven't really talked about the Seahawks offensive philosophy on Sunday, which Pete Carroll...
Oh, that would imply that there was an offensive philosophy on Sunday.
Pete Carroll praised their patience after the game. And it was obvious that the level of urgency was much higher for the Seahawks in the fourth quarter after they fell behind.
That's
and Russell Wilson started running.
That's some wishful thinking here. It's to say that the times that they were good was... Oh,
no,
that's when the urgency kicked in.
Good offense.
They played bad. Russell Wilson made bad throws. He had balls tipped, like those deep balls that he was throwing to Tyler Lockett and DK Metcalf. He wanted to complete those passes and didn't complete those passes. When they ran the ball with Chris Carson and he lost 3 yards on that on the first series, they didn't try to lose 3 yards. Like
you know the difference between the good offense and the bad offense.
I do not think that they ran the good offense. I think they got. They happen to be more efficient, but I'm not sure if the I do not believe that the philosophy was different.
Russell Wilson scrambling. There was
a lot of Russell Wilson scrambling
in the fourth quarter.
Look, Russell Wilson is a better quarterback in the fourth quarter, but I don't think you could just say that the philosophy was different when it was good and than it was when it was bad. The philosophy is the same.
Feel it even before they scored, just
there was some urgency about it. I agree with that.
That's what I just said was there was urgency.
But
Why are you disagreeing with me?
I don't think the philosophy was different. I think they wanted to do the same things and they executed better on those two drives, and it probably amounted to they got lucky. As with all things in football, they got lucky when they were successful and they were unlucky when they were unsuccessful. Like, you can't just say, "Oh, when the things went well, then," like, that you sound like fucking softy over here. Like,
you know, there's a good, this is a, when you just,
there's not
a existence of a good offense.
I do not believe that there is a good and bad offense this year. That's right.
You've never heard of play action before?
Well, I mean, there are some more inspired drives than others, but I don't think that this was it.
I'm sorry. It's not good or bad. It's more inspired.
But it's random when the inspired drives come out. It's not like you see it and you're like, what the fuck was that? Why don't they have that be the offense all the time? But it's not like when they need more urgency, it happens. It kind of just appears out of nowhere, right? It's like there's like a poof of smoke, and then all of a sudden a good offense appears, but that offense does not appear often, sir. And look, hopefully that offense is the head coach of the Houston Texans next year. And
I don't know if there's a leverage stat in NFL Fast Art, but I would like to look at Russell Wilson's rushing by leverage situation, because he runs a lot more when they are down in the fourth quarter. Let me tell you.
I think that is probably true, but I don't think that means that they're running the good offense.
I mean, look at the second touchdown drive. Russell Wilson scrambles up the middle for 11 yards. Russell Wilson scrambles right in for 16 yards.
Do you think he wasn't trying to scramble earlier?
Yes, I do think so. I think he was trying not to get injured.
I saw him try to scramble and get tackled earlier in that game. Because
Russell Wilson gets faster when the fucking game is on the line.
That actually might be true. Like, I think that every single thing that people believe about football is wrong. Any sort of talking point when it comes to the sport
of
football,
when there are mutually exclusive things that people believe, somehow they are both wrong.
That is exactly true. But I don't believe this idea that the Seahawks just like found this truth, right? That they ran the good offense.
They knew it the whole long.
They weren't trying. The game did not matter. I think winning mattered, and it felt nice to them in these last couple of drives, but the game ultimately did not matter.
They didn't approach it as if it didn't matter.
If that were the case, I think that they were trying to play offense good in the first three quarters. I didn't see a game where it was like second and 13 and they kept running the ball. Brian Schottenheimer was trying to call a good game.
They were passing a lot. I don't disagree with that.
That's what I'm saying. Like, Shoddy was trying to call a good game and they weren't executing. They don't call play action enough because they're a bad offensive philosophy.
No, they don't call play action enough because they think that you need to establish the run.
Because no one calls play action enough.
Well, that's indisputably true.
I would say coming into this game, I do not buy that they were running the bad offense in the first three quarters. This is because
they were patient. Patient is code for bad offense.
So that's Russell Wilson, when he was throwing those bombs to Tyler Lockett and DK Metcalf and missed them by 15 yards, he missed them by 15 yards.
These bombs were they on third and 13 or were they on first and 10?
There had to be at least one that was, I think there was one that was not on third and 13, but he was trying to complete those passes.
Like, I'm not saying Russell Wilson isn't trying to, but you know that there are better plays and worse plays.
I don't know if I agree with that. I think they missed some of the plays early and they happen to hit them late. I think that it is all randomness.
Nicholas Dalton Cast is making a comeback.
I'm sorry, but like, I think we're trying to add too much of a story to they happen to score touchdowns on consecutive drives. Like, do I agree that there was an urgency about it and that Russell Wilson, I don't know. I think he could have run for first downs earlier in the game. He would have run for first downs.
He's it's not like to take the same kind of risks with his health.
I didn't see that using the eye test.
Well, I did. I saw the fuck.
What was the risk that he was willing to take when he ran for like 40 yards in that game against Washington in the second quarter? Like, I suppose
he'll never run beforehand, but clearly he runs a lot more in situations where they need it. Like, you go back to the.
I think what you're seeing as an amateur football fan is more of a byproduct.
An amateur football fan. Wow.
Is it more of a byproduct of the type of defenses are playing than it is of a difference in Russell Wilson philosophy?
I'm not sure that distinction matters. I think that's a distinction without a difference.
Okay.
He still ends up running more in fourth quarter.
He runs more because the running lanes are more open when on clearly obvious passing downs or whatever.
When was Russ going to keep it on a read option? It's going to happen at some point, right? This has got to be the win. But this is my whole
thing.
Someday
we're getting that Miles Gaskin pop pass. Look, Jake Browning.
We got it. We got it in the fucking Rose Bowl. It was almost at the Rose Bowl.
Can we just – Dwayne Haskins, they lost to Dwayne Haskins.
I mean, sure they lost to Dwayne Haskins, but Ohio State had a lot of fucking talent on that team. I like
Jake Browning was on the practice squad of the Vikings. Was that that was Browning who started that, right? Jake Browning's been a permanent practice squad fixture, but I'm still mad that they lost to Dwayne Haskins.
Well, I mean, Jake Browning has not been spotted at any strip club's post game.
That doesn't affect your performance on the field.
It affects your ability to stay on the roster, as it turns out.
Okay.
Ordinarily, I would say coming into a playoff game, the Seahawks need to have this level of urgency from the start. I'm not sure if it's John Wolford or injured Jared Goff. They do. This may be a game where the offense just needs to come in with should come in with the philosophy of don't screw things up.
I'll tell you, we talked about hours ago when we started this conversation. What pulling a Pete Carroll is. And pulling a Pete Carroll is saying that a person is totally healthy when they're actually severely injured. Oh. But also, pulling a Pete Carroll is you just give them enough. And it is, you play some defense, you hit a couple field goals. And I think that is what's going to be the philosophy in this game. And I think in this particular game, it probably will be enough. I don't see the Seahawks crushing the Rams. I haven't actually seen a spread for this one, but maybe there isn't one because we don't know whether it'll be Wolford or Goff, but.
Well, quarterbacks don't matter. So there isn't.
Quarterbacks don't matter.
In the Rams offense.
Yeah, they said the same thing about the 49ers too. They've said the same thing. That's the part that I really take offense to, which is there's no offense that quarterbacks don't matter. That it is literally, it is antithetical to the sport of football. Quarterbacks always matter. There's no offense that makes quarterbacks good. And there might be schemes that put quarterbacks in slightly better positions than others, but you still end up with Sean McVay, offensive genius, and fucking John Wolford, 21 of 38 for 200 yards. Like,
McVay's offense kind of may have gotten figured out. We'll see. I mean, I don't want to say that too confidently.
I'll tell you whose name we've gone way too far without mentioning. KJ fucking Wright. Like, come on. KJ Wright is the best player on this defense. It's been figured out because you don't buy that. KJ Wright is playing better.
Is better than KJ Wright.
This year?
I think so.
Is KJ even a Pro Bowler? He's played out of his goddamn mind this year. Like, KJ is out there.
He's no Dick Ballore.
KJ has made every single play this year. Jordan Brooks, Bobby Wagner, this linebacking core. Like,
what about Quandre Diggs? No.
He made a weird play on the ball to Kittle, but
sure.
I feel like KJ Wright has been ridiculous this year. If he's not a Pro Bowler, which I think he isn't, thinking back on this, it is ridiculous. It goes to show that people aren't actually paying attention.
It is ridiculous. I think it more likely is a case that they assign Pro Bowlers outside linebacker based on fame. pass rushers.
But KJ has played a brilliant season and made so many plays in that 49ers game and is going to be huge in this Rams game. But the idea that you could just take any quarterback and replace him with any other quarterback in these schemes, it's like, no, get the fuck out of here. That's my review. Maybe if it's the University of Alabama and it literally every single position, you have every single one of the best players on the field. That ain't what's happening in the NFL. And this love that we have for backup quarterbacks is absurd. And the same thing that we have with John Wolford, it goes to show. I mean, we talked about this earlier. We had this conversation, which was also respond to this conversation. It's a two-way street communication. How many quarterbacks have played their first or second start as a playoff game? And from the short bit of research we did, Connor Cook, short-lived Oakland Raiders at the time quarterback, played his first ever start as starter, but we're invoking AJ McCarron and Joe Webb at the time.
His third start in the playoff game for Minnesota.
How many of those quarterbacks do you think won those games?
Probably not.
How many of those quarterbacks do you think had a moment where somebody said, you know, I've seen Connor Cook and I don't even think it's a hot take, better than Derek Carr. Somebody was out there who said that. Somebody said that Joe Webb was better than Teddy Bridgewater. Somebody said that AJ McCarron was better than Andy Dalton. But the answer is when you're Jared Goff and you've been to you're the number one pick in the draft, you've been to a fucking Super Bowl, you're better than John Wolford. Like, is this even a conversation that we're having? Jared Goff started a Super Bowl. John Wolford has started one game and didn't play well. This idea that we're comparing the two is absurd.
Seattle fans are too low on Jared Goff right now because they saw him 2 weeks ago and are taking that as representative of his entire career, even though it was the first time
roasted the Seahawks every game of his entire career before this. But all of a sudden we're like, Jared Goff. Like, what do we need to see to be scared? It's a disease that we have as fans to always think whatever else is out there is better. And look, all I'm saying is that whoever the next coach of the Husky basketball team is, they're going to put a fence around the state.
Oh no.
It's always bad. Everything is always bad. Every other thing is always bad. And that other thing this week is named John Wolford. And that's who's bad. And that's why the Seahawks have a 78% chance of winning this playoff game against the Rams. You're not willing to go there? You're telling me Russell Wilson is playing John Wolford at home and you think that's too high of a percentage chance of victory or not high enough?
Too high. I cannot possibly be that confident. I mean, he was playing CJ Beathard last week. It was a struggle.
CJ Beathard is a much more experienced quarterback than John Wolford is.
He is more experienced. I agree with that. I don't think he's a better quarterback than John Wolford.
Are you kidding
me? The other thing we should talk about here.
You don't think? What has John Wolford done that has, is it the going undrafted? Is it the not being good in college? Is it the not being good? Literally, what has John Wolford done to
shoot his last year at Wake Forest?
I'm
scared of his ability to run, and you should be scared of his ability to run too.
I'm not, because we got Jordan fucking Brooks, who we drafted to stop. And we had the scenario in mind. When the Seahawks played John Wolford in a playoff game, Pete was like, he was there in April. We were there watching the NFL draft. We were like, when the Seahawks come up against running quarterbacks like John Wolford in the playoffs, we are going to need speed like Jordan Brooks. But KJ Wright, we have been sniffing this out. I dare John Wolford to run. I would love for John Wolford to run the ball. If that is the Rams game plan going into this game, for John Wolford to run the ball, then bring it the fuck on.
Seahawks are very bad against defending running quarterbacks in their system. The other
it's different. It's different. Maybe with Jamal Adams not out there, maybe that changes.
Told me that it was less than 50-50 that Jamal Adams was going to play. Like, you keep changing your mind. It was only 15 minutes ago you said that. The other opponent the Seahawks are playing against that you're not giving enough credence to here is the possibility of rain at Lumen Field on Saturday, which thankfully the forecast is not as bad for Saturday as it could be given the rest of the last 2 weeks in Seattle, Washington. But it's about a 1 in 3 chance at this point of rain during game time on Saturday.
I'll take it. Well,
so I'm going, all that said, I'm going like 60% chance of winning if Wolford plays. And like maybe 55 of Goff plays.
Okay.
This is close to a toss-up to me. I mean, the Seahawks are 4.5 point favorites. 78% is way too confident.
Okay. Cool. It'll be stressful, I'm sure, but the Seahawks are winning this fucking game. The only thing that I'm bummed about is that the Seahawks are hosting their first playoff game since 2014. And that we won't have fans in the building to
officially announce that yet.
We've only got a few days to sell those tickets if they were going to have fans in the building. That they're not going to have fans in the building to cheer them on in this game. And, you know, Pete mentioned this a couple weeks ago on the broadcast, and he's like, we can feel you out there in Seattle, and you can hear in Fairwood, Washington, the fireworks going off. Maybe prematurely sometimes, but when the Seahawks win, but I'm just excited for playoff football in Seattle again. I look forward to having the same conversation, but about Taysom Hill next week. Taysom fucking Hill. He's named after a park. Also, I see that first over under for Arizona that I put under, and I'm already upset. It's not going to be good, Chief.
We start with the Arizona Cardinals, a line of 7.5 wins this season. You went under, I went over the Cardinals, despite their loss on Sunday that knocked them out of the playoff race, won 8 games. That's an over.
I'll tell you, the Seahawks were a Benson Mayoa standing over center away from the number one seed. And also the Cardinals were a Benson Mayoa standing over center. Oh, and a DeAndre Hopkins Hail Mary from being under on this one. That was a skin of their teeth over for the Cardinals.
Atlanta Falcons, a line of 7.5 as well. Obviously, we both went over. We love the Falcons. They won 4 games. That's another.
How did they only win 4 games?
Baltimore, a line of 11.5 wins this season. We both went under on this one. We were both correct as Baltimore finished 11.5. 11.5. Buffalo, a line of 9 wins. I went under inexplicably on this one. You went over. They won 13 games. We are back. Even Carolina, a line of 5.5 wins. Again, we both liked the over on this one. They won 5 games.
And again, Carolina seemed good the entire year. Like, the fact that they didn't get to 6-10 is crazy to me.
Oh no, I just saw a lock. Chicago.
Yeah, don't look at that lock. Look, don't consult the Bill Barnwell podcast about this one either.
Well, no, that wasn't it. A line of 8.5 wins. We both went under on this one. And in fact, with their loss on Sunday to the Green Bay Packers, they made the playoffs, but with a record of 8-8.
There it
that
is.
Under Cincinnati, a line of 5.5 wins. We both like the over on this one. We're expecting a full season from Joe Burrow. Unfortunately, his injury helped doom them to a 4-11-1 finish. So we were both wrong on that one. Cleveland, a line of 8.5 wins. We both like the under on this one. They won 11 games. Dallas, a line of 9.5 wins. Obviously, we both like the over on this one. Dak Prescott. How could a team with him possibly not win? You know, a lot of preseason hype about the Cowboys. They won 6 games after his injury. Denver, 7.5 wins. This is better. We both liked the under on this one.
There
they
we go.
Finished 5-11. Our lock for both of us, the Detroit Lions, over 6.5 wins. They had such bad luck in 2019, surely bound to improve. Instead, they went 5-11.
And really, 6.5, I still look at that. And if you told me if we played this whole season again, could the Lions get to 7 wins? Of course. But again, I had just listened to, this was the one that I was saying about the Bill Barnwell podcast and their season preview. I think this was with Sheil Kapadia, maybe. The number one seed in the NFC was the Dallas Cowboys. I think they confidently agreed on that. And they really felt like the Lions were ready to unseat the Packers. And I freaking bought into the hype on the Lions.
Oh my God, this is delightful. Green Bay, a line of 9 wins. That was too many for me. I said under. They merely won 13. You did get this one. You took the over. Houston, a line of 7.5 wins. How could we not take the over with Deshaun Watson there? Instead, they finished 4-12. Indianapolis, we both liked the over on 9 wins. They did, in fact, hit that with 11.
There we go.
Jacksonville, 4.5. What do you think we picked?
Oh, God. Of course we both were over.
Both over. They went 1-15. Claimed the number one pick.
They were a solid 1-15, though.
They worked hard to win that number one pick. Kansas City, we both liked the over of 11.5 wins, which seems kind of shockingly low in hindsight. We were, of course, correct about that.
This was one we did the... We did this after they'd played the initial Thursday night game. And I said on that podcast, I wouldn't be surprised if the Chiefs went undefeated this season. And that's what I'm taking one W.
I mean, they certainly weren't undefeated.
They were 15-1. That is within territory of, I wouldn't be surprised if they were
14-2.
Okay.
Because they were 14-1 when they really tried.
They were 14-1 in games that Pat Mahomes started.
The Las Vegas Raiders had a line of 7.5. We both liked the under there. They hit the over going 8-8. Did they win?
I think
on
it's
Sunday?
8-8.
Who knows what happened in that game eventually on Sunday?
I think that, wow, they did win, and they celebrated that loss of draft picks.
Well, some teams didn't. Los Angeles Chargers, 7.5 wins. I liked the over. You had the under on this one. They finished with 7-9, so the under
there we
got
go.
This one. Los Angeles Rams, a total of 9, a line of 9 wins. Despite picking them to win the NFC West,
yeah, how did you have
last
them
year, I had
under.
The under, and you had the over. They got to 10. That's the over. We both like the under on Miami at 6.5 wins. This is so bad. This is a bloodbath. People could have voted. Obviously,
if it means anything, we don't have any credibility to begin with.
That's good. And no one is still listening. They won 10 games, hit the over. Minnesota, a line of 9 games. We both liked the under on that one. They won 7 games, so we were correct on that. New England, a line of 9 wins. You thought over on that one. I took
Is
the
this
under.
The first one that we've differed on and you got it?
No.
There was another
Arizona.
One.
It was literally okay. The first one we did. New Orleans, a line of 10.5 wins. We both liked the over there. We were both correct as they went 12-4. New York Giants, 6.5. Both liked the over.
I think I beat you here.
I'm 6-10.
Glancing at this. I think I beat you comfortably the year for the first time ever.
New York Jets, we both liked the under there. You know what their line was?
So, they were 7-9 last year. Like there was no reason to expect that the Jets would be this bad this year.
There was a reason to expect that the Jets would be this bad this year, and his name is Adam Gase. They obviously went 2-14, dramatic under Philadelphia, 9.5 wins. We both like the under here. Now we're getting some momentum.
Dude, I'm seeing some W's coming up here. We're on a bit of a tear.
Yeah. Pittsburgh, 9.5 wins. You took the over. I took the under. Obviously, they hit the over as they went 12-4. San Francisco, 10.5 wins. Both went under that one correctly. Didn't know that it would be as easy as it was with the injuries as they finished 6-10. Seahawks, a 9-win line. We both liked the over. Of course, they finished 12-4. Tampa Bay, somehow I went under 9.5.
It is funny looking at these in hindsight, and you're like, what was I thinking at the time?
I think it was thinking that Tampa Bay was way too hyped, I guess, but they were correctly hyped in this case, as they were, in fact, quite good. Tennessee, a line of 8.5 wins. We both liked the over there.
Pretty surprising 8.5 line for Tennessee.
And finally, Washington football team, a line of 5.5 wins. We both liked the over, and we both got that one correct. So the final tally. You did swamp me this year.
I did great. What are you talking about? I did excellent in these over-unders. Thank you.
You did. Tristan goes 20-12 overall. I went 16-16.
And I'll tell you, my process on all the ones that I missed was right. Looking at these lines, the Cleveland line, 8.5, that feels right. I mean, Dallas, when you look at Dak being injured, could they have gotten to 10 wins if Dak would have been healthy? Probably not, given how they were playing. But
defense was not great.
I mean, I think Vegas didn't miss that many of these by a ton of games. Atlanta was one where Atlanta was definitely better than a 4-win team. And Detroit at 6.5. I don't know. Like, I don't think there were that many teams that surprised us massively this year. It wasn't the type of season where we had the 49ers have the second pick in the draft and then all of a sudden be in the Super Bowl.
Yeah. I mean, to me, some of the most obvious ones are ones that just was the same thing as last year. So Kansas City, 11.5 seems a little low in hindsight.
I mean, I don't know. The thing that was surprising was there were these breakout teams. I think maybe the breakout teams are never the ones, like last year was the Browns, right? And this season it was the Lions for some reason. I don't know why. That everybody was like, that's going to be the team who's going to put it all together. And
Tampa Bay, you could say, was that, and they did, in fact,
but they added the best quarterback of all time, literally the GOAT.
They had Jameis last year, though.
And so we talked about this on that podcast going into the year, which was of these new quarterbacks of Phil Rivers, Brady. Is there anybody else? Maybe Alex Smith coming back.
We didn't think Alex Smith was going to play at this point. No.
We had a conversation which was like some of these older quarterbacks are going to new teams are going to play well. And it feels like all of those hit, you know, at least the Rivers and Brady ones did. I don't think as having demolished you in these over-unders.
We finally got one.
I think this is the first time I've ever beaten you in this. Is that right?
I think so, yes.
Wow.
And we first did it the year of the live pod when we did it with Danny Kelly, right?
And he did great that first year, right?
Oh, Danny did great, and then Ben did great the next year. And then we were like, no, we're not inviting a third person anymore.
I'm curious to hear if they did 20 wins great in those. Because that's pretty good. That's comfortably making money in Vegas. Good.
Danny went 21-11 the year that he did it. So, yes.
And Ben?
Ben didn't do as well as I thought he did, actually, I guess. Or no, he did 20 as well.
20. All right. Yeah. Phenomenal year from Ben, just like myself. Well, thank you to everybody who participated in the Peltoncast Fantasy Leagues this year. To all of the Peltoncast.
I forgot we had the listener email.
Oh, shit. We have a listener email deep at the end.
From Matt's Mouse. Dear Peltoncast, I tried to drown my sorrows from my improbable Peltoncast, home of the Super Bowl 48 champs championship matchup loss tonight by listening to this week's Peltoncast, only to make it to minute 110 and discover that Kevin absolutely jinxed my victory chances. Kevin, they're down by 68 points to Rainier for life, so it looks like Matt's Mouse is probably going to pull this one off.
Oh, no.
Josh Allen and Stephon Diggs combined for 73.8 points. Please extend my congratulations to Jared and Michael. That's the Miyako's revenge tour.
Oh, wow. That was a revenge tour.
And please only use this incredible jinxing power for good in the future.
Well, look, Matt's Mouse, what you've earned is something that I didn't earn by having the best team in the best league, of course. And that is being back in the best league and in the 2021 NFL season, being part of the Peltoncast Champions League. So Matt's Mouse, you'll be there despite the fact that I outscored everybody in the regular season and every single team that happened to participate in the playoffs. Every single league, every single week, I'll be in whatever B or C or D league of the Peltoncast because you hate competition. And but Matt's Mouse, Miyako's Revenge Tour, and that entire Revenge League. I'm excited to see if the revenge continues into the Peltoncast Champions League next year, because the revenge is strong with the people from the city of Renton against you, good sir. But
well, okay, yes.
There were two teams in the league taking revenge specifically on you.
So the other champions,
and they
of course-
both... They both made the playoffs and will be in the Peltoncast Champions League next year. This is like John Wick style right here. Did you kill their dog? Like the amount of revenge that was happening in that league is unprecedented.
So again, congrats to our other champions, Guga Ben, third Pelton brother Ben Baldwin,
never heard of his friends.
And in the Peltoncast Champions League, it was Chris Wheeler for Napkin Taxonomy who took home the championship.
Congrats for scoring less points than me in both the first round of the playoffs and also the playoff final, despite the fact that you had Alvin Kamara. Now, congrats to Chris Wheeler.
On that note,
thanks for listening. We'll see you again next year for another NFL season, assuming that it happens. Thanks for listening with us during this NFL regular season, and stoked to be here for the playoffs.
Yeah, I look forward.
We'll probably see you on Saturday for an emergency pod.
There's going to be an emergency pod. It's a question of who will be with us on that emergency pod. So.
Oh, wow. Hello.
That's a promise. A third Pelton brother will be involved.
Wow. On the emergency pod.
You're damn right.
Wow.
On that note, thanks for listening.
Thanks. I'm curious what you have in store.